Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors.
It has happened again to the President of the United States. This is Friday, the 15th of January, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead on today's show, the U.S. is releasing all available doses of the coronavirus vaccine. A World Health Organization team lands in Wuhan to investigate the origin of the coronavirus. Not everyone is enjoying working from home during the pandemic, and tennis pros will arrive well before the start of the Australian Open. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. The Democratic majority U.S. House impeached President Donald Trump Wednesday, charging him with inciting an insurrection attempting to overturn the Electoral College vote count at the U.S. Capitol last week. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, the trial in the U.S. Senate will not start until after President-elect Joe Biden is inaugurated next week.
In the same chamber they evacuated just a week ago to escape pro-Trump protesters attempting to overturn the election of Joe Biden as president. The U.S. House of Representatives impeached President Donald Trump by a vote of 232 to 197.
Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors.
The single article of impeachment charging Trump with inciting that insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
After Vice President Pence informed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that he would not invoke a U.S. constitutional provision temporarily removing Trump from power, the House voting to impeach in a heavily locked down Capitol protected by the U.S. National Guard. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The president saw the insurrectionists not as the foes of freedom, as they are, but as a means to a terrible goal, the goal of his personally clinging to power, the goal of thwarting the will of the people, the goal of ending in a fiery and bloody clash nearly 2.5 centuries of our democracy.
Most House Republicans argued the president's actions did not rise to the level of impeachment, but some acknowledged his role in the riot. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said the president should be censured for his actions.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding.
Now the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice, Trump has defended his speech at the rally before the riot. But he condemned violence on his behalf Wednesday.
No true supporter of mine could ever endorse political violence.
10 Republicans did vote to impeach the president.
My vote to impeach our sitting president is not a fear-based decision,
including high-ranking Representative Liz Cheney, who condemned Trump's actions as the greatest betrayal ever by a president. The impeachment now moves to a trial in the U.S. Senate, where some Republicans could join Democrats to convict the president. Brookings Institution scholar Elaine Kamark said the next few days will play a key role in Republicans' decisions.
If we see a huge and ugly attack on the Capitol in the coming days, then I think there will be even more energy for conviction. If in fact, however, the tensions go down, then it's possible that the energy could go away and senators decide, no, they don't want to go as far as convicting President Trump.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announcing that trial would not begin until at least the day before Biden is inaugurated, possibly stalling his early agenda during the pandemic. Brookings Institution scholar Elaine Kamark.
That'll be unfortunate for Biden and unfortunate for the country, mostly because the one thing we are all waiting on is we're waiting on getting money for COVID-19.
In a poll taken after Wednesday's riot, 56% of registered voters said Trump was responsible for the violence at the Capitol, and a slight majority said he should be removed from office. If convicted, Trump would be barred from ever again running for federal office. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. South Korea's Supreme Court upholds former President Park Geun-hye's 20-year prison sentence on corruption charges. Asia's chicken farmers are confronting the region's worst bird flu outbreak in years, with the deadly virus affecting farms stretching from Japan to India. The U.S. bans imports of cotton and tomato-based products from China's Uyghur region. Afghanistan and India discuss counter-terror cooperation and peace efforts. And President Tsai Ing-wen thanks the United States for its staunch support during a call with the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Kelly Craft. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOANews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. Racing against a surging COVID-19 death toll, the United States is releasing all available doses of the coronavirus vaccine and has instructed states to immediately begin vaccinating Americans 65 years old and older and adults with medical conditions. Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the story.
This mass vaccination facility in Manhattan, New York, has the capacity to vaccinate 10,000 people every 12 hours. But with the current state allocation of 300,000 doses per week, there is simply not enough vaccines. Howard Zucker from New York's Department of Health.
We're going to need more vaccines. We consider this a wartime mobilization in that lives are on the line every minute of every day.
Meanwhile, other states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey cannot administer their vaccine supply quickly enough. The Defense Department said more than 29 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been delivered nationwide. But according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 9 million shots have been administered as of Tuesday. Dr. Graham Snyder is the Medical Director, Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
You need somebody to give the vaccine. You need a place to give the vaccine. And then you need the electronic infrastructure to schedule, to do all the scheduling and communication. That includes education about who should and shouldn't get the vaccine, side effects, and monitoring. What we have seen so far has been varying models of who provides that.
Earlier this week, the federal government said it will release all available doses of the vaccine instead of holding half in reserve for second doses. It also released new guidelines on who can get the shot. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar.
We are telling states they should open vaccinations to all people over age 60, 65 and over, and all people under age 65 with a comorbidity with some form of medical documentation as defined by governors.
President-elect Joe Biden has pledged to deliver 100 million shots in his first 100 days, beginning January 20th. He emphasized equity in how vaccines are distributed, particularly to poor people and minorities who most often hold vulnerable jobs such as supermarket cashiers and bus drivers. But so far, there is not enough data on the demographics of vaccine recipients. Tyson Bell is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Virginia Health System.
If you don't have that data, then you're really just walking blind. And what we know from the historical experience of this country is that if we are not looking specifically at populations that are at risk, then they ultimately get left out.
On Tuesday, the U.S. reported its highest number of COVID-19 deaths in one day, 4,327, according to Johns Hopkins University. 380,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus, with 23 million cases nationwide. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, a fire raced through a sprawling Rohingya refugee camp in southern Bangladesh Thursday, destroying hundreds of homes, according to officials. No casualties were reported. The UNHCR said more than 550 homes sheltering about 3,500 people, as well as 150 shops, were either totally or partially destroyed in the fire. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. After months of accusations that China was obstructing an independent investigation, a team of World Health Organization experts has landed in Wuhan, China.
As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the team will try to uncover the origin of the coronavirus that has killed nearly 2 million people around the world.
The WHO's fact-finding mission in China did not get off to a great start. Chinese officials blocked two members of the WHO team from boarding their plane in Singapore after they tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies. The rest of the team landed Thursday in Wuhan, where they will spend about a month. The first 2 weeks will be in quarantine at the insistence of Chinese authorities. Beijing has repeatedly been accused of obstructing an independent investigation into the coronavirus. Beijing has also attempted to deflect blame for the devastation brought by the global pandemic. For the World Health Organization, it is a tricky diplomatic and political situation. WHO Emergencies Program Chief Mike Ryan insists the team does not intend to blame China or anyone else.
Let this mission and let other missions be about the science, not about the politics. We are looking for the answers here that may save us in future, not culprits and not people to blame.
More than 120 countries have called for an independent investigation into the origins of the virus. Many governments accuse Beijing of not doing enough to contain its spread. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has been especially outspoken, frequently speaking of the China virus and demanding the United Nations hold Beijing accountable. China, for months, rejected calls for an international probe. But in July, China and the WHO finally agreed on a plan. China insisted on allowing its scientists to do the initial research. That research could be invaluable, says Archie Clements, an infectious disease expert at Australia's Curtin University.
It's not like nothing's been happening for the last 12 months. So there's a lot that's been happening and a lot of evidence has already been generated. So one of the tasks of the WHO team is to go to China and to meet with scientists and to look at the evidence.
But so far, China has not revealed what its scientists discovered. Clements hopes the WHO team will soon gain access to that data.
A big part of these sorts of investigations is actually around developing relationships with people, having that personal contact, being able to ask questions privately in a safe environment, you know, building rapport, having the sort of conversations that, the open-ended conversations that may bring out things that you hadn't previously anticipated might be important.
The coronavirus was first discovered in late 2019 in Wuhan. Many experts believe the virus had long been present in bats, but was transferred to humans through another wild animal sold at a market. With the absence of facts, disinformation and speculation have abounded. Some U.S. officials have suggested the virus may have leaked from the nearby Wuhan Institute of Virology, one of China's top research labs. China has increasingly rejected the idea the virus originated in its country at all. Some state media reports claim it may have been imported by way of frozen seafood from Italy. A team of Chinese scientists recently argued the virus originated in the summer of 2019 in India. In March, a Chinese foreign ministry official offered an unfounded theory the U.S. military may have brought the epidemic to Wuhan. The World Health Organization hopes its team will soon offer answers, even if preliminary. And experts like Clements agree.
What I would hope is that politicians, global leaders, give the investigator team some space to be able to do their job, which is a scientific task. It's not a political investigation.
But WHO officials have cautioned the team may not conclusively trace the exact origin of the virus. That's in part because, experts say, viruses change very quickly. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. A Hong Kong internet service provider says it has blocked access to a pro-democracy website to comply with that city's national security law. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
The International Labor Organization says millions of people forced to work at home because of the coronavirus pandemic labor under poor and exploitative conditions. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
Prior to the pandemic, an estimated 260 million people, representing 7.9% of global employment, worked from home. The International Labor Organization expects this number now to be substantially higher. The ILO says problems affecting workers often are invisible because they occur within the privacy of their own homes. The report finds home workers in low- and middle-income countries are most at risk. It notes about 90% work informally within the confines of their homes. They produce goods that cannot be automated, such as garments, handicrafts, and assemble electronic items. ILO senior economist and an author of the report, Janine Berg, tells VOA people churning out these traditional industrial products are unaccounted and easily exploitable.
They don't have social protection coverage. They're more likely to suffer occupational safety and health risks. Some people are working with shoe glue, or they're working in unsafe positions, for example, that can cause musculoskeletal disorders. Their earnings are below the minimum wage. The working hours are very hard to predict. You know, sometimes they have periods of very intense work, and sometimes they have periods of no work. So there's all this kind of instability.
In the global north, the report finds an increasing number of white-collar professionals working from home. They include teleworkers and home-based digital platform workers. Berg says they are usually worse off than those who work outside the home.
Again, you're working from home, you have these challenges of social isolation, and then there's risks over time of a deterioration in working conditions, even if you are a professional white-collar worker. And also, because you're at home, you're less likely to be part of a trade union, you're less likely to have that kind of voice and dialogue that you would with management to kind of address some of these limitations in working conditions.
The ILO report says higher-skilled professionals earn less on average than people working in an office. For example, it notes those working remotely earn on average 13% less in Britain, 22% less in the United States, and about 50% in India. The ILO expects home working will continue to expand in post-COVID years. It says laws to better protect home workers must be enacted. It recommends the establishment of a labor registry of home workers and a system for monitoring their working conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening in Asia, Indonesian divers resumed their search Thursday for the remains of 62 victims and the cockpit voice recorder from the Sriwijaya airplane that plunged into the Java Sea soon after takeoff last weekend. Stay with us for the latest news from and about Asia at voanews.com and all of our digital platforms. The world's leading democracy should form a coalition to counter China's human rights abuses at home and its support for authoritarianism overseas, according to a group of British lawmakers. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
More than 50 pro-democracy activists were arrested earlier this month in Hong Kong, the latest crackdown by Beijing on political freedoms. So how can Western democracies respond to the challenge of an increasingly assertive China? British conservative lawmakers have set up the China Research Group to answer that question. Tom Tugendhat, chairman of Parliament's Foreign Affairs Select Committee, is co-founder of the group.
What we're trying to do is to encourage it to change within a rules-based international system so that the people of China have the opportunity that they deserve, and so the rest of the world is not threatened.
It is a battle with global implications, says China analyst Steve Tsang.
China under Xi Jinping is interested in exporting and supporting authoritarianism in the world. So there is a bit of a contest of two different ideas, liberal democracies and Chinese supported authoritarianism.
Among the policy recommendations are the formation of a coalition of 10 leading democracies to counterbalance Chinese influence and sanctions against Chinese individuals accused of human rights abuses.
And we know about the mass sterilization and detention and indeed enslavement of Uyghur Muslims. We know about the persecution of Mongols in Inner Mongolia. We know about the persecution of Tibetans. And we now know very clearly about the repression of democratic rights in Hong Kong. And all of these should be met with sanctions.
The toolkit also recommends forcing greater legal obligations on foreign banks and financial institutions to prevent the erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy. But the West has limited leverage, argues Sang.
We are looking at some of the leading Western banking and financial institutions. So they will be the ones that will be hurt much more than the Chinese party state itself.
China is the biggest trading partner for the United States and Europe, but any policy toolkit will have limited impact, and global democracies must instead win the battle of ideas, argues Sang.
If we cannot win the arguments with reality of democracies, then we will not be able to outcompete China's approach to supporting authoritarianism.
To counter that support, the China Research Group wants Britain and its allies to go much further in exerting leverage on Beijing. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
We continue on VOA Asia. 1,200 tennis players and officials from around the world will face strict COVID-19 controls as they start to arrive in Melbourne ahead of the Australian Open. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
All players taking part in next month's delayed Australian Open must be tested for COVID-19 before they travel. They'll arrive in Melbourne on 15 charter flights and will stay in 3 dedicated quarantine hotels. Players and their support staff will be allowed to leave their rooms for a few hours to train at secure venues. Fines up to $15,000 could apply to anyone who breaks strict biosecurity orders. Tennis officials have said the Grand Slam would help the economic and psychological rejuvenation of Melbourne, a city that endured Australia's longest coronavirus lockdown. Emma Cassar, Victoria State's interim commissioner of COVID-19 quarantine, says she believes the event can be held safely.
If we focus on the testing regime for a moment, so all players and their plus ones will be tested daily. So that's 6 nose, throat swabs and 8 saliva swabs. And that's in addition to our staff who also are tested daily when they're on shift. For people who aren't playing and coming out of their hotel rooms, it is the same as mandatory quarantine, which is testing on day 3 and day 11.
In Queensland, state authorities are tightening mandatory biosecurity procedures for travellers returning from overseas, after a cluster of the highly contagious British variant of the coronavirus was discovered at a quarantine hotel in Brisbane. Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk.
I think we need to immediately look at the way in which we are handling people coming into the country, international arrivals, and also at the quarantine hotels that they are going into. Everybody in Australia needs to be aware that it's really stepped up to that next level. So I think everybody needs to be on a higher alert with this particular strain.
In March, Australia closed its borders to international travellers. Along with mass testing, sophisticated contact tracing and strict lockdowns, border closures have been a key part of the nation's response to COVID-19. The number of international passengers arriving in the states of New South Wales, Queensland and Western Australia has been cut in half until mid-February to reduce the risk of exposure from the highly contagious British strain of coronavirus. An official inquiry blamed breaches in hotel security for a deadly second wave of infections in Victoria last year, which forced the city of Melbourne into a 4-month lockdown. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Amy Hybels, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Do your best to stay safe and enjoy the day.